Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. This is
our 1 year anniversary, everybody.
Wow.
Happy birthday.
Our first episode aired on Valentine's Day 2015.
Oh.
So we're a day before. Wow. Anyway.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, have any of us at this table actually committed to something for that long that didn't pay?
My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
I was trying to figure out what to say there, because surely there have been, I have projects that, my performance art duo that I used to be involved.
You mean Goody
with.
Lawrence?
Yes, we did that for about 14 years.
This is true.
It didn't pay.
No.
Sadly.
All right, I'll accept that. 14 years is a long, yeah, you guys had a really good long run. That's
but we
for
didn't
sure.
we didn't do anything every week though. So this is I'm actually really proud of us for keeping this up every week. So thank you and
thank you.
You're welcome.
You make
all
it.
My goodness.
You make it happen.
Yeah,
I do. Okay, that's why I get the big bucks.
Yes,
and by that I mean.
Love.
Love.
All right. So, seeing as how we've been on the air for 1 year, an entire year just came to an end. 2015 just came to an end. And with the end of the year comes the best and sellers and the worst sellers. Let's talk about the top sellers of 2015. Chris, I see you have a list right in front of you.
I've got a couple lists. So, I wasn't quite sure if we wanted to talk about single issues or trades. So, I might just kind of quickly touch on both. So let me start with single issues. And Nicole has given me her phone.
hopefully that's you had.
Can you read it?
Okay.
So for single issues, and we track by quantity sold and revenue. I'll just do quantity sold. Our number one seller was hands down the series Star Wars.
Wow.
This is a composite of all the issues of a run. So that's how this is kind of ranking.
Darth Vader, Lando.
Just the Star Wars title.
The core title.
Darth Vader is number 3 in our top 20
Whoa.
List. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Star Wars is our top seller by quantity. Followed by Secret Wars, because it was actually popular. And then Darth Vader, and then Amazing Spider-Man, because they launched like 7 issues in a row, like within a month.
Okay.
That's the trick. The mainstream stuff will always show up high on the list because of tricks like that. Weekly titles and all that.
Variant covers, that sort
that,
of thing.
That counts towards
okay.
it, too.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and this is how a lot of the top 10, top 20 lists, whatever, are made of, like just dollar value and quantity value.
Okay.
Then after Amazing Spider-Man, Saga breaks into the top 20 and top 10, whatever. And then Batman, Walking Dead, Descender, Miss Marvel, Justice League, and Unbeatable Squirrel Girl ties with Justice League.
Interesting.
This is us. This is just our store.
Sure.
Just saying. I won't bother with the rest of 20. I'll stop at 10 there. And then if we're talking about trade paperbacks, our top selling trade of the year for sure was Saga Volume 5. Saga as a series was our top. I should have printed that list up, but I'm dumb and whatever.
It's the Brian K. Vaughan ongoing from Image.
Yep.
And the trades usually come out once a year, too.
And I'm just going to kind of composite these two really quick. Why did I print this whole thing up? Miss Marvel is one of our top sellers. Part of that, too, is because we had G. Willow Wilson here for Free Comic Book Day, so that bumps numbers up. And Miss Marvel 2 and 3 are all in here. But Lumberjanes was high on the list. It was number 6. And let's see here. Sex Criminals and Descender and Fables. But Fables was a cheat because the last issue of Fables was also the last trade of Fables.
Right.
So people who were buying the series were forced to buy a $20 whatever trade if they wanted to finish it. I call
since
that dirty pool.
Yeah. Since it was, I am way behind on Fables.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of my favorite books, but I'd buy it in the trade. So was there a lag between the final ish, the second to last issue, and then the trade conclusion?
I don't think there really was. I think they planned that one out well.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. I don't remember there being anything. East of West makes the lists, as does Wicked and Divine, Rat Queens, Autumnlands, Squirrel Girl, and Nimona. Nimona was on a lot of top list for all stores, I noticed. And Nimona is by the creator of Lumberjanes as well. And she almost won a very prestigious book award this last year.
Almost?
Yeah. I think she did win a different award this year. Something like that. Yeah. So those
they put,
were...
They put stickers on the Mona now saying...
Yeah, stickers saying, buy this.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
How well or how closely to do your sales here at Comic Extension track to national trends?
It's interesting because when we look at like further industry, like a larger scale one, there's big differences. Saga definitely is like number one across the board. But then comparing to like, there's not many websites that go online and post this information, Comic Source. I've only really been able to find like three or four besides ourselves. And then they get some extra traction on other news sites. But our trends are very, very similar to a few of those stores.
Okay.
And the number one trends were definitely Saga, Miss Marvel, Lumberjanes, Nimona, and Rat Queens. And a bunch of other similarities. Batman trades were a little bit higher. The one that is very interesting to note that in our like top 200 trade sales, the first like significant Batman trade or DC trade is The Killing Joke. And so a book from over 20 years ago is the best-selling thing that DC can put out right now. Other stores I know can sell the Snyder trades much better than we can. So I'm sure there's big regional differences there. And Marvel trades, like Civil War is at the top of a lot of lists. It is somewhere in the top of our list, but it's dwarfed by a bunch of other stuff. Hawkeye was the year previous, the Matt Fraction run of Hawkeye, but they ran late. Took too long. Your candy's gone. That's what happens.
Pa-cow!
Yeah. So yeah.
Cool. So is there anything, just kind of hypothesizing for the moment, is there anything coming out this year that has been announced or is on sale already that you can see being in the top 10 or the top 5 for 2016?
It's really tough to really tell that stuff. One thing that's worth noting, not to continually push the thing that we should continually push, Faith, the book Faith from Valiant sold out at the distributor level the week before release. So that means that you could not reorder copies that would be first prints, and the book had not actually shipped yet. That's happened a few times, but that is a very good deal. And I wouldn't expect Faith to have the largest of print runs, but it wouldn't be a slouch either. So I think that's a very good start on a popular book or miniseries. But when you're talking about these kind of composite numbers, that'll get kind of dwarfed fast because some weekly title, Batman and Robin Eternal, that comes out once a week, like that number will just kind of, it's dirty pool, it cheats, you know, that we're going to sell more of a weekly comic series overall by the end of the year than a four issue run like Faith.
Right.
Just the way it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, nothing's really catching my eye yet, and that's a little worrisome.
Well, I feel like there's some stuff by Image. There's some people who are names who are going to be putting out some stuff, like Brian Lee O'Malley's going to do a thing. But I feel like that's going to be like a short-term spike, you know, kind of like the mini-series sort of situation where, you know, and maybe the first quarter it's going to look really good, but overall it might not pan out. So,
but I think a lot of those things are kind of their own nice little islands in the sea of drudgery of these numbers that we have to shift through, you know, because there's a lot of these things that are like predictable. Star Wars trades are always going to be up high. It's just the way it is. But if you can tell by comparison, self-contained miniseries or short runs, and they do these really cool runs like this and things like selling out before release happens, that tells you something about the tone of the industry. You know, people are ready for different things.
Yep.
All right. Well, you mentioned Star Wars. Star Wars is obviously very popular.
Yes.
And I'm sure a lot of that has to, and some of that is due to the new movie coming out.
Yep.
But there's recently on an episode, I talked about this web series called What If It Were Good? Because I really enjoyed it. And it's from a company called Belated Media. And this guy basically goes through and he reimagines the prequels. Like if you were a story exec and he had, you know, kind of sway over George Lucas. And then Cole, I think in like a subsequent episode, mentioned how he was annoyed with fanboys rewriting the prequels. So I urged him to watch the entire thing again. And Cole, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I was initially annoyed because I guess I don't really get it, especially when somebody like Michael Barrett at Belated Media with this show, what if it were good? I guess I don't get the point, especially an incredibly creative person going to this, going, putting out this much energy to rewrite something that's already done and finished and, you know, out of the barn. But he does an exceptional job, because I did last night. I sat down and watched all three of them. And, you know, have you guys watched any of these?
I have not.
Okay.
Sorry.
Well, he's Barrett. He's very charming, but he's got a bit of a potty mouth, and he's a bit of a hipster. And he has a Wikipedia page, and he is an actor. In fact, I was like, he played young Jerry Seinfeld on an episode of Seinfeld. I'm like, oh, that's perfect.
Oh, I did not research his background.
I did a little bit, because, you know, I was starting to get more and more intrigued with his intellect and his creative process. But in the first one, you know, he has some really good points of how to restructure a lot of the material that's already there in the Lucasfilm and retell the story. But when he gets to episode 2 and 3. He just totally goes off the beam and tells his own story. And to his benefit, he's got a woman who's illustrating images that are cartoon illustrations that help enhance the story in a very successful way. So, but ultimately, what we're talking about is fan fiction. And this mm-hmm. is, and I guess that's how I put my head back around it, is that, you know, there's always been fan fiction to one extent or another in a lot of the shared universe stories, especially Star Trek back in the day. And it was a different medium by which fans shared their stories. You know, it was typing them up at home and Xeroxing them off and sharing them with their community of fan fiction appreciators. And now it's the interweb, and mm-hmm. he's getting thousands and thousands and thousands of hits. So I guess I want to put it to you guys, what is the inspiration? Well, I think we know what the inspiration is, but what's the drive to tell these kinds of stories, to retell an established story?
I think where this is concerned, where he's rewriting the prequels, is that Star Wars, the property, is such a beloved thing. And yeah. a lot of people felt betrayed by
Absolutely.
The prequels, because it wasn't what they wanted. Now, mm-hmm. regardless of what the movies were, Lucas wasn't going to appeal to everybody. You know, you can't please everybody. Somebody's going to find fault in it, or somebody's going to be like, you should have done this, or you should have done that. But Lucas went so far afield mm-hmm. from where his fan base was at the time that I think people just couldn't help but do this mm-hmm. to rewrite it.
Because he's not the only one who does it. There's dozens and dozens of people who do this type
and
of work.
I think... It's a method of healing. Huh. I think it's
yes.
a way to make
it's therapy.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. Yeah.
There's another aspect for it to me as well. This attempt of deconstruction, reconstruction uh-huh. is in itself a creative process that I learned from a professor that I took a playwriting class from. And the first exercise he had us do as a class was, everybody give me the worst plot twist, trope, anything you could think of. It was his sister. It was a clone, whatever.
And the butler did it.
And we wrote a story. Uh-huh. And then we read the story, the short story. And when we were done, it was this steaming pile of poop. And everybody had fun. And he was like, great, don't do that. Like, and that was the quickest, best lesson.
That's great.
And so that's something I took from me, from that I kept from that class. That's just like, we need to really recognize why things go wrong. Mm-hmm. This is like history in general. Mm-hmm. But just so that we can not do it again. And if you can actually try to fix it in some way, it's a healing, cathartic kind
yeah.
of deal.
Sure.
Yeah. So
I frequently think about, wouldn't it be marvelous if we lived in a world where when pictures were remade, they were the pictures that studios choose to remake were ones that failed. You know,
right.
Let's not remake a film that was good.
Right.
Let's not remake Charlie and the Chocolate right. Factory. Let's not remake The Thing.
Yeah.
Let's remake Saturn 3.
Let's remake Earth Girls Are Easy or something.
Well, I mean, okay, that one appeals. But, you know, most of the Brian De Palma library. You know, let's remake films that had promise that, you know.
That's an interesting idea, is to remake films and fix what was wrong with them.
Precisely.
Not reboot them entirely.
No.
This movie had a terrible plot twist or a terrible plot hole. Let's fix that.
Yeah.
So we're redoing all the M. Night Shyamalan.
Yes.
Yeah,
except for Unbreakable.
So what a twist.
I think another part to fan fiction that might not apply necessarily to the prequels, but I know that applies to Force Awakens fan fiction, is that there's a lot that people want Poe Dameron to be gay online. And I think that some of fan fiction is to have characters that you can relate to, like seeing yourself on the screen, just like we say in comic books. And I know that that plays a big role in fan fiction as well.
And it was a subgenre of Star Trek fan fiction. Yeah. You know, there was this BDSM and soft porn and hardcore porn where people were rewriting the relationship of Kirk and Spock to their needs.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really valid point.
See, I continually want to write a fan fiction where right before the New 52 was launched, because the reason that was launched was a Flash went back in time and smidged something up. Right before he does that, the Spectre shows up and be like, "Whoa, Nelly there. Leave that alone. You don't know what you're about to do. Let's just go back to the other stories."
But I also want to go back to particularly Mr. Barrett's talent as a storyteller. And I look at this and I go, gee whiz, what could you do with you're clearly inspired to go to great lengths to tell these stories. What you could not do with your own material. I would love to see something come out of that. And every once in a blue moon, a fan fiction writer would break into the mainstream. I think Diane Duane, who was a very popular Star Trek novelist, was a fan fiction writer. Yeah. And she wrote, I think she may have actually written episodes of Next Generation. But the one person I think of is Devin Grayson, who was the pen name of the woman who wrote Batman back in the 90s. She wrote Batman Robin porn, and I got my hands on some of it back in the 90s, and it was surprisingly good. And you know, to the point where this actually might be a threat to DC. No, they weren't threatened by her. They hired her.
Right. Yes.
And she wrote,
great job, DC.
Yeah. Identify talent.
No, and she did some, what was she, writing?
She was doing
Batman?
Nightwing, I thought. And she did Detective.
Batwing.
A bunch of like the No Man's Land stuff, I remember.
Yeah.
And I thought she did the Teen Titans stuff or the Titans.
She had an affinity for Robin, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. She put a lot of herself into Robin. And I was really impressed with that. And I think she's kind of gone off the grid, but that was not her real name. I met her at a con in Chicago years ago. But
I think the industry mistreated her.
I would not doubt it.
Yeah.
Ben, you had a comment.
I mean, you're saying that why can't Michael Barrett put his talents towards other use? I'm not going to say he isn't. I don't know the guy. Maybe he's written a lot of great stuff, you know. And this is just like a hobby, a passion of his that he wants to fix. You know, I see where you're going with don't waste your energy writing fan fiction because ultimately it doesn't matter. But it does matter to some people, to him especially, you know, to like when I watched it for the first, this series was recommended to me. And when I watched it, I really enjoyed it. And at the time I hadn't seen the prequel since they came out in the theaters. And quite honestly, had forgotten what they were all about. So for a time, his summation of the movies was like my cliff notes for the prequels. And I actually didn't want to revisit the prequels. I wanted those to be my reality. Yeah, I wanted that story arc to be what I took away from the prequels and going into watching The Force Awakens.
Sure. Well, and then we have this schism between that which is canon and that which is not. And we're struggling with a lot of, you know, post-Disney Star Wars canon expanded universe expulsion, you know. I would love to see him write some Star Wars stories because he's a great storyteller.
We could always, too, for our own mental health, pretend that there's a Phantom Menace from Earth 1 and a Phantom Menace from Earth 2 and accept a grander multiverse of the Star Wars verse.
Sure.
And it's a dangerous road.
You're reworking it to fit your psychology, which I guess is a point that I missed when I was originally feeling critical of his work because I was a little bit befuddled as to what the purpose was, and then I had to sort of sit down and re-examine that.
All right. Well, Michael Barrett, if you're listening to this, email us at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what else you're up to. We'd love to see it. All right. Speaking of Poe Dameron, apparently Marvel hasn't announced which Star Wars characters will get miniseries next. So you said that, Chris. Star Wars hasn't announced, but then I saw a link that Poe Dameron is getting one.
Yeah.
He is.
Yeah, I think I sent you that email a few weeks before that. It's like, magic, there we go.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It might have even been like the day before or something. So that's happening. What other characters do we want to see get a special run or a one-shot?
Admiral Akbar.
Oh, yeah. Yes!
This guy one shot called It's a Trap, and it just shows him like getting out of traps for his entire life.
I like
until
to
he
see,
gets promoted to general.
See, that's what I was gonna say. I'd like to see Admiral Akbar like up for review every year and just staying at Admiral. No, we don't think you can. We like you at Admiral. We're not gonna advance you.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite guys. So. I'm totally with that. See, before I was kind of thinking, like, what about, like, a Joe Schmo kind of thing? Like DC did, like, the, you know, the Gotham Central, even though I haven't read that yet. Like, the kind of, you know, background
the
players.
The background.
Yeah. But, like, you know, you could make it interesting in some way. Because everything's always grandiose. Everyone's, like, the one with the force and the thing. And, dark now. And, oh, this person rules everything. You know, like, what about the people on the farm?
What if you were that guy at the bar and suddenly a Jedi pulls the lightsaber out and an arm lands on your lap?
Yeah. Like what happens at the bar? What happens here?
You go home, honey, you are not going to believe.
Like, it could be, like, stories from May's bar or something like that, you know, and all this ridiculousness ensues, and it's just all these people coming in and out and passing by. And
I always love the robot chickens where there's a janitor at the bottom of all the shafts where, like, the emperor keeps on falling or something. Like, people keep falling. They need to do a new version of that where, like, Han Solo lands or something.
Yeah.
Spoilers.
And I think we've already broken that. I think it's either like Family Guy or Robot Chicken or one of those like satirical leaning cartoons has done sort of like the regular
DeBaba, the guy that got his arm cut off and Dr. Emerson, they've
his
all had their
career
Robot Chicken stories
or the regular like construction workers on the Death Star, you know, just
right.
going
yeah,
through their
yeah, totally. Yeah. Like that, they could make that really fun depending on who they put on.
I was thinking about this because I actually was reading a Chris Hardwick piece where he talks about it's a Chris Hardwick piece in this compilation of Star Wars articles that my friend Nick Reichardt picked up for me when I was recovering from surgery. And he talks about how his favorite character is R5-D4, the robot that gets, you know, that gets rejected in A New Hope. The one that has the red one, the bad motivator in his head pops off.
Well, Peter David did this story where he was that robot was a Jedi. Like, the Force was strong in it, and like everybody neglected it, but it was actually a key moment of the Force, making sure that R2-D2 made it to him.
Sure.
And that, so yeah, Peter David did that story.
Yep,
that was great.
I was thinking, well, there are tons of these, you know, peripheral characters because we have all these rich peripheral characters in, you know, the immediate and the expanded universe. And I'm thinking, who do I? The mouse droid.
Oh, the little guy in the.
I'm like, I want to know that guy's story because whatever story he has to tell is going to be only in ones and zeros. You know, his capacity for anything is going to be really limited. But to tell, you know, the story of this little guy's existence on the Death Star before it blows up, you know, and getting scared by Chewbacca.
Some metaphysical story of his thing's life.
I don't know. Yeah. I just think of him like the great grandfather to the Roomba.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there could be a great story about his lineage and how he came to this. You know, this is a big deal for him to get.
Got a promotion.
You know, to promote
it was his last day on the job.
You know, this rolling shoebox that I don't know. What does it even do? Does he sweep the floor? Does he carry messages?
He leads stormtroopers.
Shine people's shoes.
It was 2 days before his retirement.
He was going to get a reboot, or he was going to get, you know, his RAM was going to be expanded, and he could have, like, you know, escalated, been elevated.
He's in line for an upgrade.
And he could have, you know, been elevated to an intelligence level of, like, a guinea pig.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been a big deal day for him.
You then I had a good one.
I don't remember what they're called, so I have to look it
up. See, I just want like a series of the animals because there was a short story once of the Sarlacc pit showing the life cycle where you saw it like get out of the sand and then like do stuff and it was ugly. It was like basically the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But like just show me what happened to the Wampa after it got his arm cut off, you know, and give me the whole planet of the Cthulhu things, the ones that Han Solo was shipping around.
Those guys are cool.
Oh, yeah.
You're trying to remember.
We got to look it up. I wrote it down. You're getting close because they were so Lovecraftian.
Yeah. Give me a whole book about just like somebody hunting them down.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, I'd also like Dengar. to see more about the relationship between the Rancor and the Rancor.
Oh yeah,
manager.
Well, there's a mini comic about that where they show like him like taking care of it and feeding it like it's a baby and raising it, and it was a very happy comic. There was a good ending to that.
Okay,
that beast didn't deserve that fate.
Some of my favorite alien races in the Star Wars world is they're called the Kaminoans.
Oh, the big neck.
They're the ones who created the clone army.
The ear picks.
I like them because they remind me of like the Abyss aliens.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it just sort of sparked something for me, and I'd be like, kind of want to know a little bit of their story. I don't know what it would look like. Someone would have to make that interesting, but.
The creatures that Han and Chewie are smuggling are called Rath-tar.
Yes, Rath-tar.
I had to look it up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Poe Dameron is getting his own comic. Has anybody else been announced?
Not that I've seen.
Since then? I haven't seen anybody else.
As of this taping? Mm-hmm. No? Okay.
No.
Cool. All right. Well, hey, friends, let's move on to Book Report. Let's start with Chris. Let's start with you.
So by the time this episode's coming out, we're like right before Deadpool.
Right.
So.
I think we're actually right after Deadpool.
So close enough. Yeah. That's okay. So I read Spider-Man Deadpool number one. And the thing is, I don't completely hate Deadpool. It's just that he's oversaturated. And he's a ripoff of a few other characters. He's Spider-Man and Deathstroke combined. But there was the run that made me like Deadpool was by Joe Kelly, and it started with art by Ed McGuinness. And this is a run back from like the late 90s or early 2000s. So this is a reunion book. It's a creative team reunion book. And it's Joe Kelly getting back with Ed McGuinness. And basically, Deadpool is, because in like some of the other books, he's an Avenger now, and he wants to be more of a hero again. And so he's stalking Spider-Man to learn how to be a hero and doing things horribly and getting in the way. And it's Joe Kelly just has a really witty, good sense of humor, and he has a lot of fun. Like, there's a big fight with the Dread Dormammu, who's a Doctor Strange villain. Dormammu, whatever.
Dormammu, yeah.
When I was a kid, I was like, Dormammu. Mamamamamu. And there's a whole sequence where, like, he's giving his, like, ethereal villain dialogue, you know, with a lot of these, thous. And then he looks at Deadpool, and he looks at Spider-Man, and he's just like, you're slumming it. Like, what's up, man? Why are you working with that guy? So it's that kind of humor. So this was just a really fun first issue. It was still totally a nostalgic read for me. But both creators have evolved over the years. Ed McGuinness is much smoother and dynamic, and Joe Kelly is even funnier. The nice thing is, too, this book comes with the entire first issue of The Vision as a free bonus. And Cole reviewed The Vision a couple weeks ago. It's the Tom King one. And so it is totally worth getting this book because it's two free comics and they're both good comics.
Wow, nice.
Alrighty.
So, yeah.
Nicole, what about you?
So I read a book called Luna the Vampire number one. It's published by IDW, and the art and story is by Yasmin Sheikh, Sheikh. And it's kind of, it's a funny, humorous comic. It's a following a girl named Luna. And she is kind of like if you combined Stimpy from Ren and Stimpy with like Lumpy Space Princess from Adventure Time, made her a vampire and shoved her on a planet, like a moon rock planet. But it's very, very girly. Like, she's like all about like, oh, what kind of dress am I going to wear? And like, oh, what's the new fad? It's to be skinny. Oh, wait, no, now it's to be fat. Oh, I'm going to eat my friend. Like, it's just weird and wacky. And the thing that actually won me over, it's all just like different vignette little stories. But one of the things that won me over, she goes to a pet shop and she finds this big maggot that's the size of like a baby with razor sharp teeth. And she's like, oh my God, this thing is kind of cute. Wait, maybe I want it. And then the guy who's working in the store is like, oh yeah, I think it's like a bat cat or something. And so she's like, I must have it. It's so cute. And she brings it home and she tries to do all the things that you need to do for taking care of a bat cat. And it doesn't do any of those things. It like rejects all the stuff. It just like falls asleep and it's like lazy and stuff. And so the guys come back and they're like, oh, I think we like made a mistake. You know, bat cats are actually like active and smart and graceful. And that's actually just a fat worm. It's like lazy and stupid and just makes a mess. And it oinks at her. And she looks at it and they're like, yeah, we'll just, you know, take it back. And nobody wants it. And she's just like, nope, you can't have it. They're like, yeah, it's not, it's just actually like food for other animals. She's like, mine. And I was just like, yes, because if I was Luna in that world, I would totally have that as a pet.
The art's very, Yeah, the art's very interesting because it reminds me of like Invader Zim sometimes through the lens of Dave Cooper. Mm-hmm. And if anybody doesn't know who Dave Cooper is, be careful when you Google search that. It's sometimes very ugly, 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 gross work.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was ugly.
But, you know, like squishy faces and blobby and lardy and globular, but like cartoony at the same time.
Right, right.
And it's like an all-age comic, and it totally appeals to my like old-time slave labor sensibilities, but with a cute girly flair to it.
For reference sake, Slave Labor Comics was a publisher in the 90s.
Not a way of life for Nicole.
Yeah.
Slave Labor did Johnny. Yeah.
No, there's barely anything ever published from them today, so I think it's worth reminding people what that is.
Yeah. Well, I had never heard of them, so thank you.
If anybody knows who they are, they're going to go, somebody else knows who they are. Yeah. So there you go.
All right, cool. Luna the Vampire, number one, from IDW. Cole Hornaday, what about you, sir?
I read the first issue of The Totally Awesome Hulk by Greg Pak and
Frank Cho.
Thank you. So I thoroughly enjoyed this book. I will keep up with it. Frank Cho is a really terrific illustrator, and I've been a Greg Pak fan since actually I saw his short films he made back in, you know, the aughts or the late 90s, and then, you know, because he's got a unique enough name, P-A-K, and then when he started writing Hulk, and then he did his own revamp of Adam Warlock and some of that stuff, he got on my radar. But I let go of reading the Hulk a long time ago, but I was familiar with Amadeus Cho character, and when, you know, post-Secret Wars, when I saw that they were going to be doing a new Hulk book, I'm like, I hope that's Amadeus Cho, who is now, you know, green and swollen. You know, they're the beautiful illustrations, big monsters, lots of humor. Amadeus is assisted by his sister, Maddie Cho, Madame Curie, Maddie Cho. Mm-hmm. And it has that Peter David feel of, you know, lots of, punch-ups you know, sexualization, and humor, and then some pathos in there, with, the backstory. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I know I've grumped before about, how, people of color and people of different cultures are depicted. And I like Cho because he's giving us, I believe he's Korean, and he's giving us a Korean character that he created, that he knows well. Are there a lot of cultural threads throughout it? No, not really. But he's in touch with this character enough, and perhaps even the cultural background of the character, to make it really vital and interesting to me. So I'm behind that.
And there's a two-headed fire-breathing dragon.
Turtle. It's a turtle. Yes. Yeah. So totally awesome Hulk.
All right. Thank you, Cole. That's our that's Book Report, and that's our show. But before we go, we play quiz time. However, I'm going to mix things up today.
Uh-oh.
Because this is our year show, I'm going to just mess with the order a bit and tell you.
No!
That I'm going to save quiz. From now on, I'm going to save quiz time until the very last thing we do, taking a cue from my favorite NPR show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, where they have a little bit of comedy at the end before they tell you that today's show is brought to you by The Panel Jumper and Comic Central. You can find everything Nicole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. You can email us at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to us at perfectboundpodcast.com or on iTunes or anywhere that you get your podcasts. You can also come to the Comic Central at 319 Northeast 45th Street, here in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Now get your quiz hats on, everybody. It's time for quiz time. This time, the questions come to us from your pal, Buzzy, a frequent quiz time contributor and a good friend of ours. And this one is titled Fantastic Fifth Wheel. Now we know.
Nice.
We know that the Fantastic Four are no more. They've scattered to the edges of the Marvel Universe. Throughout their history, the team's lineup has often been fluid, as founding members have disappeared, stormed off, or dropped dead, seemingly.
Nice.
But over the years, many heroes have stepped in to round out their roster, thus saving the gang from having to renumber their uniforms. How well do you remember these super substitutes? Number one, when Invisible Woman Sue Richards found herself pregnant with her first child, what member of the Inhumans' royal family stepped in during Sue's maternity leave? Okay, Cole is pointing to Chris. Chris, say it out loud.
Medusa.
It's Crystal.
Oh, it's Crystal? Oh, okay. I thought Medusa was there at some point.
Because she was dating Johnny Storm.
Oh, right. Okay.
Crystal is the correct answer. Number two. When the Thing lost his powers, the team put this hero on hire on the payroll. Cole is flapping his wing like a bird.
I believe it's She-Hulk.
No.
Oh.
Hero for hire, Power Man.
No.
Oh.
Spider-Man?
No, the answer is Luke Cage, everybody. Luke Cage.
Power Man.
The answer is Power Man.
Wow, that's good. That one.
All right. All right. I don't know these things. I've never read the Fantastic Four. Number three.
What?
Sue and Reed. I did see the movies, however, all four of them.
I'm sorry.
The Fantastic Four movies. Sue and Reed Richards took a break from superheroing in the aftermath of Civil War. What royal couple came forward to fill in?
Black Panther and Storm.
Yes, sir. Number four. This Femizon warrior from an alternate future timeline wanted to test her mettle in battle against Ben Grimm. But eventually, she developed a thing for the Thing. Name her.
Thundra?
Yes, sir. Number five. In the early 90s, the Fantastic Four were presumed dead, and these four loners came together briefly to form the new Fantastic Four. By default, Wolverine is in every supergroup, but for... So for one-third of a point each, name the rest. Cole.
Was the Grey Hulk, Mr. Fix-It.
Okay. Chris?
Spider-Man.
And Cole?
You already said Wolverine, right?
Yes.
And then Ghost Rider?
Yes, sir.
Well, I was mouthing Ghost Rider at you.
Oh, I mean, oh, I was.
But sure. you had to do the motorcycle thing with your wrists.
He's trying to give me clues since I didn't know.
All right, thank you for listening. That's our show, and we will see you next week.
Woo-hoo.